Okay, so I want to talk to you a little bit about the future. What's happening in Boston in the years following health care reform? And I want to look at the linkage with you between public health, primary care, and community-based organizations. I'm going to cover briefly background, surveillance in the era of expanding electronic health records, how we let healthcare providers know what's going on in their neighborhood, engaging the community, and providing direct service in the neighborhoods. So the Boston Public Health Commission is, I think they need the guy in the back to take care of that. Thank you. The Boston Public Health Commission is the local health department in the city of Boston. We have a population of a little over 600,000. The city health department currently considers chlamydia an epidemic, with a citywide case rate of 781 per 100,000 population and rising. But rates vary. When we look at 15 to 24-year-old Boston residents, the case rate is 3,574 among Black and Latino residents versus 402 in white residents. It's 3,048 per 100,000 in women versus 1,326 in men. But if you look in a neighborhood and you look at a population, there, the Black women in Mattapan, which is one of our neighborhoods, have an annual chlamydia rate of 7,387. To try to address this, the City Health Department has developed a five-year goal, and we've been working to start reaching that goal. It is to reduce the chlamydia rates overall and to reduce the racial ethnic gap by 25%. This is not an easy task. We need to change the social norm. We need to build coalitions. We need to understand both social and sexual networks. And of course, we need to expand treatment resources that are available. Neighborhoods with the highest rates of chlamydia, as you may expect, have the lowest socioeconomic indicators. And for those of you this morning who heard the second of the plenary talks, the map went up of areas of violence in the city of Boston. You can superimpose this slide right on what was being shown by that speaker. So these neighborhoods have very low socioeconomic indicators, but Massachusetts has had universal health care coverage for a number of years. In fact, by 2008, 97% of all Boston residents had health insurance coverage. No neighborhood had a coverage rate less than 90%. So it's going to take a lot more than health insurance to solve this problem. So I want to talk a little bit about surveillance in the era of growing use of information technology. City Health Department regulations that became effective in 2013 require reporting of STIs directly to us by healthcare providers, institutions, and laboratories. As you may imagine, reporting from providers is somewhat incomplete, and laboratory feeds provide limited data other than the actual test result. We're trying to move towards a solution here by getting the local health department access to medical records in healthcare sites in the city. We already have access with one hospital, and we now have a pilot ongoing with one of our community health centers. We have 25 in the city, and they are not health department run. They're either FQHCs or they're hospital licensees. We do have at the City Health Department a local surveillance system available to accept information on the Massachusetts Health Information Exchange, or the Mass Highway. Unfortunately, the HIE data is not quite ready to be sent out. But more importantly than how we collect the information is how do we use it? It's key to get out local data to people who need to know it. So we have provide results, including neighborhood-level data, to clinicians and healthcare facilities because we've found they're extraordinarily interested in what's going on in their own neighborhood, whether it's hepatitis B or tuberculosis or chlamydia, they want to know and they want to be part of the solution. We formed a chlamydia advisory group that is primarily clinicians to help us develop some best practices and share ideas about how we might tackle this chlamydia epidemic. We use this local data to advise clinicians how to target particular areas and how to test and to treat. And these collaborations allow a better understanding among everyone about the social and sexual networks that exist in a particular area. To give one quick example, I made a visit to a community health center of one of our high-risk neighborhoods. They have extraordinarily high chlamydia rates. And you talk to the clinician, and they say, well, it's because a woman, a girl, is passed among all gang members. And there are a lot of gangs in that area. It's a recipe ripe for spreading a lot of STDs. This just demonstrates chlamydia rates by neighborhood, and this is the type of information that we feed back. The dark blue neighborhoods are those that have the highest case rates, and they include Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, and part of Hyde Park. I could pick another map and show you where hepatitis C rates are highest, but it would be on the east side of the city. When you look specifically at 15 to 24-year-olds, the same neighborhoods light up: Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, and part of Hyde Park. So what is our role as a city health department? We have to engage the community. We have to engage the community. Frankly, they're the people who know how we're going to solve this. We fund 14 community-based agencies to do education and outreach in their neighborhood related to HIV, STIs, and hepatitis B and C. We form a lot of partnerships without us providing any funding with many community organizations. A few examples. In the Boston Housing Authority, we've trained their resident health assistants on STIs. At the YMCA, they have teen nights in some of these high-risk neighborhoods. Our staff go out there to provide information to the teens. The NAACP sponsored a Black Ministerial Alliance meeting related to HIV. Well, we kind of joined that meeting and talked not only about the importance of HIV, but the importance of chlamydia and the importance of teaching people how to protect themselves. And yes, in fact, we found out that some ministers will directly distribute condoms. Barbershops. We hit the barbershops in the high-risk neighborhoods. They get free condoms. They get educational material. We have a group called the Boston Alliance for Community Health that is a group of neighborhood coalitions that look at a range of health issues. They help us with trying to integrate what we're doing and reach people we need to reach. The Boston Public Schools have Boston school-based health centers and a few schools where there is a clinician, but they also have what's called a health resource center in some schools, which do not have a clinician, but can provide chlamydia testing, condoms, and health education. In addition to these school-based health centers that are run by the City Health Department, some of our neighborhood health centers actually run school-based health centers also, and so we link with them. And coming up is Take the HIV Test Week in Boston. It's at the end of June, but many of our partners who are going to be going out and offering HIV testing are willing to add chlamydia. The thing we had to do was link them to a clinical provider who would accept these people, and so that will be added on this year to our Take the Test Week. We've piloted a study to provide direct local health department services in some of our neighborhoods. It's focused on finding the lost 15 to 24-year-olds who have confirmed chlamydia, have been reported, have not been treated. When we get that report, one of our nurses contacts the healthcare provider to verify the treatment still has not been done. If there has been no treatment, he or she then asks the provider if they would object to the City Health Department nurse going out and actually treating the patient and offering EPT. I don't believe we've ever had a provider decline. The nurse goes out with a gram of azithromycin and a bottle of water. They're used to knocking on doors. They do it for tuberculosis. They do it for hepatitis A. They do it for salmonella. They know how to knock on doors. They give the case directly observed treatment with the azithromycin, and then they inquire as to whether it would be safe for that person to give EPT to their partners. And we've struggled somewhat with how do you assess this. But our chlamydia advisory group has someone from Children's Hospital on it who said the way they ask this question is, who's in control of the next time you have sexual intercourse? And who decides whether condoms are used? Which is a really nice way to ask who's in control of the situation. Collaboration has also identified some very creative practices. As you may know, we have a number of institutions of higher learning in Boston, and so last summer we did a survey of college and university health centers about their sexual health and sexual testing practices. Most institutions had either on-campus or off-campus STD testing services that they could readily identify. Some did not. Some had no educational material on sexual health for their students. We provided some, provided some for that audience. And we asked them about best practices. What are you doing that you really think is resonating with this audience? And so we have the Condom Fairy at one of our universities. And there will be more about this in a talk later today. She delivers, so you can too. You can order supplies online, and the Condom Fairy will bring them to your mailbox in an envelope. We also decided we needed to do more outreach and education about chlamydia, which again is one of our City Health Department goals. Using information obtained from focus groups that involved over 100 youth aged 15 to 24, including homeless youth, Peer Leadership Institute participants, they would be peer educators, the Men's Health Crew, a group of young men interested in health-related issues, particularly among communities of color, low socioeconomic status groups, Young Women, their Leadership Academy, again, it's in our target age range, and gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth. We took all this material from the focus groups to develop a media campaign. Now, we don't have a lot of money, right, because we're at the City Health Department. We clearly couldn't afford to do this thing all over the city. So we asked these kids, well, where should we put this to reach you? They told us very clearly, put it on buses, don't put it on the subways. Kids don't look at what's on the subways. They don't use the subways. Look at the buses. We then analyzed chlamydia rates by census tract in the city. We identified the bus routes that ran along the census tracts with the highest chlamydia, put posters on those buses and in those bus shelters using our tagline, "It could be hiding in you," which uses a camouflage theme, which again the focus groups helped us to develop. So in summary, health insurance alone isn't the answer. Neighborhood level data is a great motivator for clinicians. Directly observed treatment for 15 to 24-year-olds has been implemented, but we need to assess the success of that. And engaging a range of partners is absolutely crucial. You have to go out to the neighborhoods. And in that work, you have to include the individuals who are most at risk. And with that, I think I'm done. Thank you.
We'll now open the floor for questions. But before that, I want to announce that there will be free lunch at the poster session at noon. So take advantage. So can all the speakers come up here? And then if you have a question, please use the mic and tell us who you are and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Diana, and I'm from the Florida Department of Health. And I have a couple of questions for the Mississippi State Health Officer. One is, do you use rapid HIV testing in your state? And do you have any mobile units?
So, yeah, we do use rapid testing in some of the sites. And actually, our director is right behind you. Mm-hmm. Who can answer that even better? But we do use rapid testing in some of the sites.
Yeah, I can. So our rapid test program is not actually health department clinic based. Dr. Currier mentioned that we have clinics statewide, but we don't do rapid testing at the health department, except for one site where we did a demonstration, which was on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. But we do support rapid testing at, in non-healthcare settings through several community-based organizations. And we have also some healthcare sites that are doing rapid testing right now. We're also planning to implement a two rapid model, just as a pilot, which would not require blood to be sent to the public health lab, but we're developing that.
Okay. I was just going to say, because some of the manufacturers of the rapid test kits do, you know, work out with you big discounts when you sign contracts and things like that. And I've noticed in the counties that I cover in Florida, we do see a lot more people getting tested because of the rapid test. You know, we actually kind of had to get the word out. And once we did, we couldn't believe how many people started coming in and specifically asking for that. And then the other question I had for you is, do you offer comprehensive sex education in the middle and high schools? I know Mississippi is pretty conservative, but and I know most half of at least half or two thirds of Florida is as well. But in the counties that do, their rates have really gone down in teens, STDs
so
and HIV.
A very interesting law. Oh, sorry. I thought my mom voice would do. we have a really interesting law in Mississippi that was passed several years ago that makes every school district offer either abstinence only or abstinence plus sex education. So every school board in a district has to make that decision. And with CDC PrEP funding, we were able to influence school policy. So there's an example of policy being influenced even though you're using federal funds and you can't lobby, to actually give them examples of evidence-based abstinence plus education. Interestingly, our legislation actually describes what can and can't be in the education, so even if it's abstinence plus education, you can't demonstrate condom use. But explaining to schools that it's not just all about sex, it's about, you know, relationship negotiation and things like that. So we do have some schools. There are about 150 districts in the state, and there are about, I think, 40 or so that actually have evidence-based abstinence plus education, so real sex education, and some of them offer it in the middle schools. So,
okay, I promise this is the last question. I just thought of one more.
I'm going to ask her a question first. So, thank you.
Hi, Gail Burstein from Erie County, New York. These are great presentations. You know, we're really trying hard also to work with our community providers to improve their, you know, clinical practices around sexual health. So I was wondering, it's probably for a question for Mississippi, but maybe applicable to everybody. When you talk about how you're focusing on screening and managing those at risk. How do you know who at the community health centers or FQHCs who is eligible for screening and not getting screened? I mean, that's what I'm worried about is, you know, the denominator. How do you know, like, who you're missing? Do you get any of those data, or you just get the data of people who are, you know, who test positive for chlamydia and gonorrhea and about their management?
So maybe Nick
can answer that. So it's an iterative process, and we're learning as we go. So in the first phase, we implemented the process at the sites, and now we need to work on how we identify the risk at those sites. For example, at one site, the testing was being done in two places. One was a homelessness clinic, and that was actually beneficial. We were identifying some cases. But it was also being done in a women's health clinic. And we wanted more testing to be done in MSMs. So I think that it's a collaborative, and it requires program evaluation measures, which we have to implement.
Thanks.
Anyone else is going to do something?
Thank you. Beth Meyerson from Indiana University. This is a really wonderful discussion. And in Indiana, where we're 50th in per capita CDC and HRSA funding and not expanding Medicaid sort of and all of that, we got together with our primary care partners and our Minority Health Coalition and STD partners to try to see if the CHCs, not just FQHCs, were screening to really standard of care for HIV, syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia. Ken Mayer's work was really instructive, and we realized, of course, we weren't even close to what you guys have in Boston. But what we're really now finding is next step. So bottom line, a bunch of the CHCs tested, nobody to standard of care, burden was on the patient to present symptoms or request the test. But there were some tools that were needed by clinicians, how to ask about sexual orientation, gender identity, how to, share that routine request for tests. The ghost in the room or the horse in the room or whatever is really reimbursement. We know there's probably some opportunities to move forward together as a collective to handle that so that we can bring resources in. We're not asking for a new system. We really want to finance that work at the clinical level so that they could do the screening they want to do. Our partners are with us at the table. So I guess the question would be, as you've worked together across with governmental public health, STD and HIV, and CHCs, which we're conceiving as part of the larger intersectoral public health system, what's the best way to move forward so that partners don't feel publicly spanked when there are wrong things found, and really bringing resources down when reimbursement is clearly the business problem?
Please use the wireless microphone. You can pull that off the podium.
I guess I'd like to speak to that from the primary care side and probably the previous question too. The importance of training the providers in primary care is really important. And maybe starting with medical directors and getting them on board so they set those standards of care and then train the physicians and the other providers to do that as a standard procedure is one thing. So primary care, we're about access and productivity and getting patients through and how much time do you have? The best way we've found to address that is our care team model. And so when you talk about talk with the primary care providers about resourcing that team so that all of the conversation isn't happening in the exam room, but they're linked and connected immediately with a nurse or a navigator or whoever who can follow up that conversation, and you're going to have much better compliance with the providers because it's not all on their shoulders.
I also just want to recommend that a resource that might be helpful to you is one of those webinars that I was referring to earlier, which will be on the Ask the website. And Dr. Burstein, who I don't know if she's still here, was part of that and really addressed that in there are two different approaches that are important in terms of the settings that you described. One was seeing if is coming up with a mechanism that allow primary care providers to explain, particularly for adolescents, that chlamydia screening is routine, that there are routine screenings. It's not based upon an assessment after an examination, but that it becomes part of integrated primary care. Figuring out how to do that, there's some sample forms and some sample approaches that they talk about that have been successful in terms of it then becoming routine, and they've had great success in the effort they've been involved in. But the second piece is reimbursement that does help, and I think Boston's example illustrates that it's helpful. Insurance really makes a difference. It often gets you in the door. But with STDs, there are these other issues that takes some attention, and one of those is the explanation of benefits issue, particularly for teenagers, is a challenge. And so thinking about both the, marrying together the access to insurance and the reimbursement with the obstacles that sometimes occur and the policy changes that are necessary, including the ones that Anita mentioned, I think really need to go hand in hand from the beginning.
So just a couple of quick things. First of all, when everybody has health insurance, their health insurer wants them to go to certain places or they don't pay. It's a huge problem. So these people who are enrolled in health insurance, yep, they can go in their network. If they don't, nobody gets paid. In terms of encouraging screening, we have a number of health centers in the city where as soon as an adolescent comes in, they give a urine sample. The medical assistant does it. the healthcare provider doesn't even get involved. And, you know, then the healthcare providers, and we're going to check a, you know, we're going to check a number of things today, and we'll check that urine sample. And but it's got to be brief. Remember, primary care visit, you get like 12 minutes. That's not a lot of time. And the third thing is about incentivizing people to want to improve their rates, if you get their rates, is something we used in an immunization rate project a number of years ago, in which we ranked sites by completeness of immunization. Well, you could rank them by completeness of screening. And we gave out charts to each site with their place identified in the queue, but nobody else identified, right? So they could see there are 25 results and, oops, we're number 24. Something's not good here. Or, wow, I'm at the top. We must be doing something great. So it was an incentivizer without embarrassment, because I really think you have to do positive encouragement with this.
Okay, any last question?
I'm Gretchen Somos. I'm a primary care resident here at Emory, and so I'm really interested in what you're talking about linking primary care with Department of Health. Our Fulton County Department of Public Health is literally across the street from our safety net hospital and has absolutely no linkage. But what I'm interested in is you seem to have predicated your linkage on a patient-centered medical home model. And do you think that that transformation, which many of our healthcare centers are in the midst of doing and is requiring an enormous amount of leadership capacity, has to happen first, or can these two things be linked together? And how can departments of public health help us to facilitate really making that care transformation happen?
I don't think it has to happen first. And in fact, I don't think the patients will wait. I mean, our experience in Massachusetts with healthcare reform is when people have access to insurance, they'll make their own decisions. And so the system, you know, has to keep up with patients rather than, you know, complete its transformation and then, you know, be ready for change. I think, you know, there's going to be an unevenness, as we've said, about how insurance expansion occurs, but around the country there's going to be more insurance available. And then once you give someone an insurance card, depending on the circumstances, they make their own decisions. So I think the simultaneous work on people coming into care now, whatever primary care looks like, and the efforts to try to develop a primary care medical home model as perhaps the optimal model need to take place at the same time, I think.
The other thing I'd suggest is that you go to your residency program director and ask him or her if they have reached out to the local health department to see if primary care residents can rotate. We have three medical schools in Boston and about 10 teaching hospitals, and they can come and rotate at the city health department. And so if your residency director hasn't done that, he or she should try.
Well, thank you, everyone, and let's thank our speakers.
Thank you.